Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, partner at VS Strategies, and with me, as always, in the flesh, on the digital tunes, is my policy partner in crime, Andrew Livingston, Director of Economics and Research at Vicente Cederberg.
Thank you so much, Jordan. It is good to be back on the Weed Wonks, getting to chat about the details of cannabis policy, how it affects business, how those businesses operate in the various different states across the country, and how they really get the money they need in order to start that business. Because today we have one of my favorite people in the world, someone that I have worked with most of my time here at Vicente Cederberg, one of the partners and the chair of the corporate practice. We have Charlie Alvesetti. Charlie, you know, really is he's not only an awesome person, he's a fabulous lawyer and a really deep thinker into corporate and transactional work in the cannabis industry. Charlie is also a recent author, along with another partner at Vicente Cederberg, Cassia Furman. And they recently came out, published, I was lucky enough to be one of the authors on two of the chapters, a book that's called The Cannabis Business, Understanding Law, Finance, and Governance in America's Newest Industry. And that's published by Routledge. And yeah, it's really worth it. I would say it's a great book because I helped to write it, but it's really a great book because Charlie and Cassia helped to pour their soul into it for most of the pandemic and a whole bunch of time beforehand. So I am so happy to have Charlie on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining the Weed Wonks.
Thanks for having me on the pod, guys.
Of course.
Thanks for the book pitch. I'll just add, you know, a few other points, you know, in case people are interested. All author profits go to charity. And it was, you know, Cassie and I really wrote the thing, but, you know, Andrew helped out a lot and, you know, a bunch of our colleagues helped out with a number of the chapters. So we tried to really tap into kind of the institutional expertise of the firm to create what I think is the only book, right, that has a practitioner's view of, you know, the industry and not just one state, but the, you know, taking a look at the thing as a whole throughout the whole country.
Yeah. So Charlie, as a practitioner of cannabis corporate law, just, you know, what do you do on a day-to-day basis helping clients navigate, you know, national, a little bit international finance when it comes to cannabis and what is and isn't allowed?
Yeah. I mean, I would say, you know, my days, which these days are nuts. Today was insane. You know, I have basically four types of conversations. You know, one, am I going to go to jail for investing in cannabis? In which is, spoiler alert, the answer is no. Two, how can I raise money for my cannabis business? Three, how can I buy/sell a cannabis business? And four, you know, we want to do some crazy thing with the corporate structure of our cannabis business. You know, like how can we do that? You know, be it, you know, giving someone equity or, you know, renaming it or forming a new company. So those I think are the four types of things that I do. And it's a lot of talking on the phone, a lot of looking at documents.
Got it. So let's start at that first one, right? Like cannabis is illegal federally. We know it is unlawful Schedule One drug, you know, most dangerous drug out there, as according to the federal government. Well, maybe not the most dangerous out there, but amongst the most dangerous as a Schedule One. You know, we know that there are tax provisions that are inequitable because of 280E and that's impact on Schedule One and Schedule Two drugs. But let's just talk about like what actually is the current federal law associated with cannabis and cannabis finance. I mean, like, how do you invest money into a federally unlawful business and why is no one going to jail for this sort of actual, you know, breaking the law in investing in a federally unlawful business?
Right. I mean, I think sometimes there's so much in the news that sometimes people forget that the federal law with respect to cannabis or marijuana, as it is in the law, hasn't really changed since 1971 with Nixon. So as from a black letter law perspective, just the way the law is drafted, you know, it's incredibly illegal, right? And it's no different than investing in like a crack company, right? Just from the black letter law perspective. But then you look at the policy, and this is the you know, it's a tough conversation to have because, you know, for people like you guys, right, you get it. You've been around this thing for a while. But I think for new investors, they're looking at it and they're thinking to self, how can you tell me that I can invest in this company that's completely federally legal and I'm not exposing myself to any risk? And that's when you sort of have the conversation where you say, well, look, let's look at what's happened since really the second Obama administration. I mean, there's not really any cases of investors in a state legal cannabis business getting in trouble from a legal perspective since the second Obama administration. Of course, you know, in the first Obama administration, when there was some prosecutions, you didn't have any of the infrastructure that exists now, right? There weren't investment banks doing reports on these companies. There weren't incubators. You know, people like me weren't in the industry. You know, people weren't drafting investment documents, et cetera. So a lot of the conversations you have with investors is just saying, you know, like, hey, you know, you can't just look at the black letter law. You have to look at the policy. And there's been a consistent policy decision on the part of the federal government not to enforce these laws. And, you know, there's no guarantees, but look at the track record, right? That there have been no prosecutions for a very long period of time. But at the same time, look at this recent case with the former Ease executives, or look at the Sweetleaf executives. You know, there are some people that have done jail time for violating the cannabis regulations, but it's not for being involved in a state compliant business. It's for pushing the margins, whether it comes to payment processing or banking or with looping with respect to Sweetleaf.
And I think that that puts attorneys in a really tricky position, right? And probably investors, you know, usually attorneys are much more comfortable saying this is where the lines are. And really, I think part of what's going on is that the lines of black letter law are that this is not okay, but the policy and practice and actions say that it's not going to cause a problem. And so, you know, having been an attorney once or twice in the past, for better or worse, those are really the tricky situations, because your clients are coming to you looking for an answer. And the right answer is like, well, you know, this is kind of what it says and this is kind of what happens. And you can't tell them that nothing bad can happen, even if you can tell them it's unlikely nothing bad is going to happen. And that's a very hard place for an attorney to be in. So how do you navigate that, that conversation with folks?
Yeah. Well, I say, you know, it's a Schedule I substance, but you know, the DEA, the FBI is not going to knock down your door. There are, however, plenty of things you can worry about, right? One, the state regulators could deny the transfer of a license. You could get dinged for compliance issues at the state level. You're going to have trouble getting banking access. You're going to have difficulty with insurance. So, you know, my life is 99% practical issues and 1% theoretical issues, you know? So, you know, anyone can tell you it's federally illegal. The hard part is how do you navigate these actual problems that people face all the time? Which are tend to be at the state and local level. It's really the federal government is sort of a non-issue.
So if the...
Let's talk about some of those practical issues. Jordan, sorry, did you...
No, I mean, I was going in the same place, right? So we have this wonky situation where the black letter law says you can't, but the entire trend of a decade of history essentially says like, well, really what you can't do is break state law and engage in shenanigans. But you don't necessarily need to lose sleep if you're engaged in an ancillary or plant touching business that is playing it safe and staying within state law. I would assume that basically creates some investors who are comfortable and some who aren't, right? And that's really the impact of all of this.
Yeah. So when you're out, so if you're a cannabis company trying to raise money, right? You know, you've got two buckets of cannabis companies when it comes to raising money. You know, the direct license holding companies, you know, what people call plant touching, and the ancillary companies. If you're an ancillary company, if you can pitch yourself as a tech company, you're in an easier position because you've just got a bigger universe of people that will potentially invest in you. If you look at the high, you know, high profile tech companies in the cannabis industry, they've had big name venture funds invest in them, right? So, you know, you got DCM Ventures invested in Ease, right? That's a big name venture fund, right? They're not going to put money into, you know, if we, you know, tried to raise money and start a vertically integrated operation in Colorado, we're not going to be able to raise venture money. You really only got one source of capital, which is high net worth individuals, AKA rich people, right? So most of the money in this country is institutional. It's not necessarily held by families. It's held by these institutions, and the institutions, you know, the mutual funds of the world, they're not going to invest in a licensed company until the law changes.
And so wait, let's pause right there. Cause I think, what do you mean by an institutional investor, right? I think everybody knows when there's a rich person and they got a lot of money in the bank and they want to put into it, that's an easy thing most people can relate to, but institutional investors are different. And why would that stop them from wanting to invest?
Yeah. So, you know, institutional money has all sorts of restrictions on what it can do because it's OPM, it's other people's money, right? So you've got strings on what you can do. Now, if you're like a mutual fund, right, you can only hold certain stocks, certain bonds. And if you're a venture fund or a private equity fund, you can only invest in certain companies. So most of these funds, most of these institutions are not going to have the flexibility to invest in a licensed business. So that's what, amongst other things, makes raising money in the cannabis industry so difficult if you don't already have a network of wealthy people that know and trust you.
So really, basically, investment comes from kind of two places. One, rich people with lots of money, or other areas that are money that's being pooled together by people. That's a mutual fund, a pension fund, all kinds of investment vehicles. And when you take other people's money and combine it together, there has to be rules and conditions on where that money can go. Otherwise, no one's going to give you any money. And those rules and conditions say you're not going to invest in an illegal business. And because they're federally illegal, those groups will shy away from investing in marijuana businesses. But if it's just you and your own money, you can do whatever you want with it. And those are the people that are comfortable with it. So, and I guess the same kind of theory would apply to banks and banking loans and Small Business Administration. Like, it's because that's the third way people get money is like lending.
Yeah, borrowing money. Yeah. So, I mean, just to clarify, we're talking about the private markets here. Private markets. Once you go public, it's a little bit easier. People will invest in you, but it's still limited, right? Which is why you see big headlines anytime an institutional investor invests in a major MSO, because a lot of their money is coming from retail investors, you know, mom and pop investors. So that's why people say, you know, the big money still hasn't entered the cannabis industry. On the debt side, right? So getting a bank loan, I assume you guys saw Harborside got a bank loan. They didn't announce the name of the bank, but most federally regulated banks won't lend to cannabis companies. So most of the loans coming to cannabis companies are coming from what are called hard money lenders, which are, again, it's high net worth people that are lending to these companies. It's not necessarily banks. So bank lending doesn't really exist in the United States in cannabis. It tends to be from funds that are raising money and lending to people, sort of like a Gotham Green or you know, these kind of hard money lenders, these smaller kind of lenders that find opportunities. I mean, they're always going to want, I shouldn't say always, but they typically want real estate to secure the loan.
So why is it that, you know, small credit unions and other kind of small mid-sized banks, which in some cases do have cannabis accounts and are doing, you know, normal banking for those businesses so that they can write checks to their employees? You know, we've talked about banking extensively in the past, and we know that it's complicated and difficult, but, you know, there's two sides of that banking. One is the debt and the loans. The other is just the straight up commercial banking side of things. So why would they, you know, hold a business's account and essentially take in their money and provide them banking services, but not also offer loans?
Well, I think it's riskier lending money. it's harder to understand, to wrap your head around. I mean, so this is a big issue, right? Well, let's talk about debt financing in cannabis, right? The big issue in cannabis debt financing is, what's your collateral, right? Can you secure the loan with your licenses? Most state regulations are silent on collateralizing your licenses. If you talk to regulators, I've been told by a regulator in Colorado, you can't secure your licenses you can't secure a loan with your licenses. Now, everyone does it, and there's nothing in rule or statute that would support your position, but that's, a regulator position at the MED. If you can believe a regulator at the MED was not consistent with regulations. But it's one thing. It's like, it's like a reservation, right? Anyone can just take a reservation, right? It's the keeping of the reservation that's tough, right? You put a lien on a license, that's fine. That's easy. The regulators probably don't even know what happened. The difficult thing is, what happens when someone defaults on that loan and now you want to collect the license? Well, that's going to be subject to regulatory approval, and that's going to take a long time. And if the licensed business doesn't want to sign the transfer paperwork, that's not going to happen. So it's a lot more difficult than, it's called Article 9, the Uniform Commercial Code, which handles secured lending law in the United States. And if I have a secured interest on your building and I have filed a UCC-1, right, perfecting my lien in that building, and you default, I can just go in and take your stuff. You basically, the sheriff can come in, kick you out of your house. It's mine now. And I don't have to, that's true security, right? There's no legal process you have to go through. If you default, I can kick you out and just take it, but you can't do that with a license. So it's a lot harder for a lender to get comfortable with that. And then you can deal with the other fact, right? It's like, well, you certainly can't take the marijuana, right? Because you can't possess that. So the asset base for one of these companies is a lot trickier for a bank to wrap their head around. And then on top of that, you got the fact that this is just a new industry. And, they're just not, banks are very conservative by nature.
So let's talk for a second about how this warps what types of cannabis businesses can start and how the cannabis businesses have to start, and how much equity they have to give, the interest rates. Like, we have obviously, whittled down from the universe of total potential investors to, a group of predominantly high net worth individuals who have, to a certain extent, their pick of what cannabis businesses they want to invest in and why. And, how does this affect it from the standpoint of someone who's trying to actually raise money? Do they end up giving up more equity early on? Do they end up taking on more debt? Is there certain things that we see as the norm? Or is it kind of scattered because all the different state laws are so different?
I mean, the state laws are different, right? And when it comes to raising money we're talking about a licensed cannabis company, the state laws really matter because, for example, in Colorado, where we had the system shift, where previously every single shareholder of the company had to get vetted and approved by the regulators, and now there's a 10% materiality threshold. The 10% materiality threshold makes it a lot easier.
So, let's
break it down. I know what you're talking about, but let's break it down. What's a 10%? It's like, is this, if I give debt, let's say a loan, right? You just give someone gives $1 million and I'm asking for a 10% interest rate. Do I have to disclose that? Is that a 10% materiality threshold? Like, what does that actually mean?
So if it's debt, there's unique and confusing rules about whether you have to disclose debt in Colorado.
And this differs state to state based on
state by state. And then when you're talking, you can even sometimes run into city specific restrictions, but it's much more common to run in at the state level, right? So, and you can imagine if you've got an MSO in 12 states, now you got to think about this issue in each state. Let's say, the three of us own a cannabis company, right? A third each. And we go out and raise money. And, there's one wealthy person that's willing to put in, they want to buy 20% of the company. In Colorado, you've got to get that person added to the cap table because they're above 10%. So they got to go, they got to get suitability approved. Then we got to do a change of controlling beneficial owner. We have to worry about the local license. So, you know, not only is this person giving you all this money, you now they have to hop through all these hoops, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, like a few years ago, that wasn't even the case. They couldn't, they had to be in state. So you can imagine.
I think what you end up seeing, I think, is that, okay, so we started out with the idea that, so federal law is the black letter federal law takes basically a group of the investors out of the pool of people who are willing to invest in a business and leaves a much smaller pool. Like if you were running any kind of other business, a pizza shop, there is the pool of investors willing to invest into a pizza shop or a pizza chain if you want lots of money. And now we've got, I don't know, 60, 70, 80% of the money that options that you would normally have, they're off the table because national banks, because of all the institutional money, as well as getting into the Small Business Administration and all of that. And then in that narrow pool of people, they also have to be willing to jump through a series of hoops that have occasionally been lit on fire by various state regulators. And if you want to run a state in multiple businesses, your investor better be willing to jump through those different hoops. And that, again, narrows the pool of people who are willing to invest to people who are not only have the money largely on their own, but are willing to actually put up with all this nonsense when if they put their money into another business, they would not have to do this in almost any other circumstances.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a limited series of businesses, you know, like, you know, there's gaming is similar. And then, you know, the other thing I was talking to, we were representing where he was like, well, I've done a bunch of sanitation deals in New Jersey and they basically run you through the ringer there because they're concerned about organized crime. So, but yeah, you're right. Like for most, you know, if you want to invest in a pizza chain, nobody's background checking you. And that's why I always thought it was a little strange when people were so worried about cartel activity. You know, if you're a cartel and you really want to launder your money, like invest in a laundromat. You know, nobody's doing background checks to the owners of a laundromat. Whereas like cannabis, you're under a lot of scrutiny. It seems like a pretty poor place to try and launder your cash.
Yeah, I think that we see that across the board. I asked a regulator at one point, because we were talking about some changes and this like that. And I was like, have you guys ever in the history of the regulatory agency, like actually found a bad guy that was in the industry? And they were like, well, you know, there was this one guy in Derpader. And I was like, yeah, but that guy wasn't like in the mafia bad guy. Like I remember that story. He wasn't like a real, real bad guy. It wasn't like Colombian cartels or Mexican cartels. They're like, oh, no, that would never happen. And I think yeah. There is this kind of fallacy to some extent, because as you pointed out, these might be illegal actors, but they are still economic actors making business decisions. And why would you ever subject yourself to that level of scrutiny? And I think what it does is, I guess it has a chilling effect on all of it. And that chilling effect means you're probably never going to find anybody, right?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, that's what's, you know, a lot of the legal changes in Colorado, and, you know, hopefully in other states have loosened it up, because the challenge, right? You know, you got to raise, it's one thing to have, you know, you just got to raise money to build a business. I mean, particularly if you're trying to scale quickly, you know, it takes money to do that.
Yeah. I mean, I would also say that, you know, the large Mexican international criminal organizations are a lot more sophisticated than people may think. And there will be layers of front man in front of anyone who would get a license. And there probably are in some places, you know, high net worth investors who they themselves are not high net worth and they get their money from someone else, right? But that's not really possible to find out from a straight up, you know, it's not like state cannabis regulators have the time and ability to check, you know, the source of every single investor's money through, you know, a multitude of potential smoke screens.
Well, I was going to say, if you're really concerned about it, you're going to have to check every investment everywhere, right?
Yes.
I mean, especially if they're laundering their money through HSBC. you know, they're, yeah, like you point out, these are not, you don't rise to the top of a criminal enterprise by being stupid.
Yeah. All right. So let's switch from criminal enterprise, and let's talk about, all right, what is the actual legal enterprises? Because I've been hearing a lot of different acronyms getting thrown around. You know, the first one I want to bring up, and this is the first person I had ever heard say use this acronym was you, Charlie, and that's a SPAC. And I'm hearing, you know, now just even beyond cannabis that, oh, the SPACs are the new thing and everyone's got a SPAC. And so first of all, what does that acronym actually mean? And how has it been used so far in the cannabis industry? And, you know, how has it become a tool to allow cannabis businesses to, you know, raise money or to make an exit?
Yeah, well, super quickly, right? So it's a special purpose acquisition company. And basically, you raise a pool of capital to then go out and find a target. So you're basically convincing the market. And by the way, I strongly recommend, you know, Matt Levine has a column. He has a newsletter. He's pretty funny for a financial columnist, but I would read what he's written about SPACs. I think he gives a great explanation of the kind of the nuances because it's pretty complex. And it may not be the best deal for the retail investor, but, you know, you basically go out, a financial group of financial people raise the money, and in return, they get, you know, a certain percentage of this vehicle, right? This publicly listed company called a SPAC. They take this bunch of money, then they find a company to buy. There's a vote of the shareholders, and basically the target merges into the SPAC, and then boom, presto, it's now a publicly traded company. So, you know, in an ideal world, a SPAC is kind of an easy, streamlined way for a company to go public.
So a SPAC is a company that isn't a real company. It's a publicly traded company that is just an investment vehicle. People put a bunch of money into it. I have bought some on the stock market. And then at some point they wake up and they buy another company. And then they become that company, right? This happened with SoFi. It happens outside the cannabis industry as well, where it's a way for people to go public without taking your company public and going through all the rigmarole. You find a company that already is a publicly traded company that actually isn't doing anything. They don't make anything. They have no widgets or services, and they buy you. And then now all of a sudden they're trading on the stock ticker without actually going public because they got acquired by a SPAC.
Yeah. So how's that different? I mean, because I thought that was an RTO, a reverse takeover, when you had a.
So an RTO is there's a shell on a public exchange in Canada, right? Most of these are like mining companies, defunct mining companies, and then you merge into that defunct mining company. But the difference is the SPAC has cash, so they can pay you for your shares. The shell, it's not necessarily a liquidity event. You're not actually raising any money by doing an RTO or a reverse merger, though you, to complicate things, a lot of times these Canadian RTO deals, they'll do what's called a subscription receipt financing, where they raise money in connection with that RTO. But
go public and issue more shares.
The SPAC, in an ideal world, right, it's got a bow on it. It's already publicly listed. They've got cash in the bank, and they've got a team of financial professionals that can give you some credibility and that can help you with the process of going public. So back, you know, up until January of this year, there's a real cash crunch in cannabis. So that's why these SPACs were a big deal, because, you know, there weren't a lot of people floating around out there with like a couple $100 million of cash looking to do cannabis deals.
So you mentioned up until February, there was a capital crunch and not enough. First of all, why was there? And second, what changed?
Yeah, I mean, so my take on it, which not terribly original, but was that, you know, everyone got really excited about cannabis. These companies raise a ton of money, then they spend a ton of money without really too much to show for it. And then investors kind of got scared off. Then, Georgia happened. The Democrats take control of the Senate and people figure, hey, legalization is inevitable now. And they're like, well, maybe we're, you know, who knows, right? The market's confusing, right? But everyone sort of decided at one time that like, hey, there's actually still money to be made and a ton of money poured in. But I think the money really went into the big names, these large MSOs. So it's not necessarily a cakewalk for the small players out there trying to raise money in the private markets just because, you know, Curaleaf was able to raise like $100 million.
Got it. So this is mainly federal politics that are changing the minds of retail investors.
That's my take. And plus, like, I think the financials of these of some of the more successful USMO MSOs, they've started to show, you know, real revenue growth, some discipline on the SG&A, and I think people feel more comfortable investing.
And so I guess I think one of the conclusions is that everything you just said is basically lots of fancy terms that most people don't understand, right? And we can get into all the different ones, but so now we talked about how the federal law basically creates a situation where there's a diminished pool of investors and then further diminishment within that pool due to state regulation. And now we've come up with another issue, which is that the ways that you can actually invest money into a cannabis business are incredibly complicated. We touched before on some of the lending issues, and now we've got SPACs. Are there other ways that folks can get in? Because so far, basically, it feels like we've got a funnel with a narrowing spigot every single conversation layer, and what you get at the bottom is a very small trickle that can be accessed by a very few people.
Yeah, I mean, listen, if you've got money, you can find some place to put it, right? They'll find you. You can join one of these investor networks, you know, like an ArcView, that'll present opportunities to you. There's a number of publicly traded companies you can invest on in the market. They're now, you know, cannabis ETFs out there. You can buy into these SPACs.
Charlie, just real quickly, what's an ETF?
It's an exchange. It's an exchange traded fund. It trades, let's see, what's the difference between an ETF and a mutual fund? An ETF, I think, trades during the day, whereas a mutual fund doesn't trade during the day. So basically, you know, it's like a basket of cannabis stocks.
Okay, so basket of other publicly traded cannabis stocks.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay, cool. Sorry, keep going. Just wanted to break that down for listeners.
But an ETF, I think, an ETF isn't giving actually money. Like, you're just buying a stock that's floating on the market. If I was that's how a retail investor could try to, like, someone who likes to smoke weed could invest in a cannabis, the industry, by buying an ETF. But if I was a cannabis business, an ETF's not going to actually give me money unless I'm a publicly traded company. They would buy my stock. So how, if I'm a cannabis business, what are my other options? So I've got SPACs to go public. I've got some loans that we've talked about. We've got high net worth individuals. What are the kind of structure options that are actually out there within those kind of variables?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's private, there's public, right? You raise money privately. You can pursue equity options, debt options. Again, if you want to pursue debt, you're going to have collateral or real cash flow. And setting aside going public, which is its own kind of, which is pretty complex. It's, you know, what most of these companies are doing are, you know, they're putting together sort of a pitch deck and they're reaching out to their networks. They might cold call venture funds that sort of specialize in the cannabis industry. You can buy these lists of family offices and just reach out to them. But of course, like a cold connection to a capital source is usually not going to be super successful because these guys get hit up all the time. Warm leads are the best way to go, but yeah, it's tough. You know, most people can't do it. The thing is, I was going to say, like, one of the challenges with a business, right, is like raising money is its own skill set, separate and apart from running a business.
And so
what does that mean for the actual practical mom and pop cannabis business? Like, how, you know, if you and I and Jordan wanted to start a cannabis business, well, first of all, Charlie, you'd be the one helping to raise the money. But like, let's say, you know, the people who don't come from the world of finance or aren't corporate attorneys, like what do they do? Like, do they have a chance of competing? Like, is it just like, oh, you got a golden ticket in a state with a limited license and now you can capitalize from that? Like, what are these people actually doing?
I mean, you know, I guess it's, you know, it's tough, right? But, you know, you're going to reach out to, you know, you have to be entrepreneurial, hit the pavement, try and reach out to people. I mean, in terms of like the professional advice side, you know, you can hire lawyers, right? That's how I, you know, pay my rent is people hire us to help them raise money. But, you know, we can't find them money necessarily. We can help them structure the thing. You can hire placement agents and banks to help you try and raise money. But again, they can't, you know, you can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. It has to be something that people want to invest in, right? So a large part of that is like, it's storytelling. You got to be able to convince someone that, like, hey, this is the next, you know, you're going to, this thing's, you see hockey stick growth, you know, you're getting, you know, it's going to moon, you know, you got to convince someone of that, which is not, you know, it's a challenge. I mean, I think a lot of the mom and pop people in Colorado, not to keep talking about Colorado, but, you know, a lot of people bootstrap these things back in the day, you know, and then you're just running on cash flow and they haven't necessarily raised money.
So, I mean, I think that that's really important, right? And it's, I mean, Colorado, I think in this story is a placeholder for California too, which has a lot of legacy industry that bootstrapped, Oregon that has legacy industry that bootstrapped, Washington to some extent, and some of these other places. So, you know, I look, when we look at the market, one of the things that people always talk about is that a lot of the market is dominated by large MSOs or very wealthy individuals or folks who had money before they got in. Right. And I think what we're trying to elucidate through this conversation, and we've talked in other shows about how policy and limitations on licenses and other things like that impacts things. This actually has almost nothing to do with license numbers and license limitations. What we're really talking about here is we have a federal law that restricts the pool of investors, state laws that disincentivize other investors from getting into the space, various limitations on the types and structures of deals that people can get into. And when you get down to the end of the money train and what is actually viable, what it results by the nature of various layers of policy is that the people who have access to that money are not likely to be the mom and pops. It's likely to be people with pre-existing connections and an ability to navigate that space. And that is, that combined with limitations on licenses is creating the outcomes that we're seeing in terms of ownership in the cannabis space and why ownership has changed so much since 2010 to today.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I think in some senses the fundraising does connect to the limited licensing, right? Because if it, you know, it depends what's your entry point, right? Like what's the lowest entry point you could find to the industry. If it's a Florida model where you have to buy a license for $40 or $50 million, you know, raising $50 million is a feat that few can accomplish, right? But raising a couple million dollars, I mean, obviously that's not easy as well, but, you know, it's much more doable, right? You can put that together with, you know, if you know enough, you know, successful professionals, but for $50 million is, you know, kind of out of, you know, that's sort of, you're not going to find, you know, you're not going to do that because you know 30 or 40 dentists.
Yeah. You know, and so this is, you know, we're kind of like evolving a little bit at the end of this conversation towards the, how these financing, how the capital constraints, how the black letter of the law as it pertains to who can and who can't invest in cannabis affects the makeup of cannabis ownership, right? And what we're seeing is a lot of states trying to bend that through regulation. They're trying to, okay, let's create a licensing system that's prioritizing for certain people, or let's create a fund. I mean, initially there was a lot of just like, okay, let's prioritize licensing for people of color that were harmed by the war on drugs. And then I think what Massachusetts has realized is that it doesn't just come out of thin air. You have to have investors, and that becomes a real problem. So now Illinois is trying to do this with some, you know, no interest or low interest funds. Other states are exploring this as well. Charlie, what's kind of your thoughts on that? Because my, you know, I think it's the money side of it is huge and absolutely important. But I also worry about, like, you know, do these people even own the property? And are they then taking a no interest or low interest loan? And then it's just getting paid into the pocket of a wealthy landlord. So kind of, you know, what's some of your thoughts here? But then also, like, are there ways to do this effectively?
Yeah. You know, I think part of it has to do with I think one of the challenges with some of these sort of lending programs that I see proposed is, you know, it's like, you know, they give someone 50K, you know, like 50K is just not enough to, so like, let's look at Massachusetts, right? You know, where you've got these delivery licenses, which are reserved for social equity people. A delivery business does not require the capital investment that, you know, 100,000 square foot grow does. But, you know, you're still probably going to need like $400,000, right, to start this thing up, you know, and you're not going to make, you know, you're going to lose money at first. It's going to take a while to become cash flow positive. So, you know, does a 50K loan do anything? I think that you need larger amounts of money for it to be successful. And I also think you need to be, you have to look at who, I guess what I was going to say, it's a tough thing to do, right? Because you want to give someone fair terms, right? Because you can also see people approach these businesses with pretty onerous terms, right? You know, I'll lend you money, but it's going to be at, you know, basically just like a point below whatever the usury laws in the state. So you have super high interest loans.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that's what we, I guess that's kind of the point of all this, right, is that at the end of the day, we can't get around federal law, right? And that I think has two major problems. One, we've been talking this whole time about the cutoff on the normal investor pool, and that when you reduce supply, you increase prices, right? I mean, that's just kind of basic economics. And then the Small Business Administration, one of the only and most effective policies that we've ever had in this country to encourage entrepreneurship in these communities of low-income persons, it can't play. They're on the sidelines. And now we've got states that are basically trying to figure this out. How do we solve these problems? Illinois has tried to do it. Colorado just passed a bill that got signed by the governor, creating a public financing program. There's $4 million put into that. There are, at least at the time I'm talking right now, they're actually advertising a position at the Office of Economic Development and International Trade, which is pretty darn cool. The Colorado state government will have a person dedicated to providing low interest loans to social equity entrepreneurs, which is really exciting and something we're really proud of. But it's hard. You know, these are hard things to solve, because at the end of the day, when you take a huge chunk of who could invest into a product, into a company, and the normal avenues of investment off the table, you inherently create an economic problem basically with supply and demand. And that's going to increase the cost of capital significantly. And then again, further reduce the ability for, you know, the not well networked individual to get a business off the ground.
I mean, my two cents is that it might be better for these laws to give people a small but meaningful stake in a company versus trying to give someone, you know, majority control when the deal actually gets structured, it turns out to be illusory, right? You might be better off with like 10% that's really 10% of a company, as opposed to 51% when it's 51%, but you don't actually get anything. If that makes sense, because you see this, yeah. I mean, you used to see this a lot in terms of residency requirements, right? So like back when, you know, I first started working with you guys, it was, you know, residency requirement was the talk of the town, right? You know, you had all these medical states that came online, they'd have strict residency requirements, and then people try and structure around it. And then it's now sort of been replaced by, you know, social equity is the new ownership constraint.
Yeah, in certain areas, it becomes this thing. And I think what we saw with residency is that if needed, business would find a way, right? That it's like water. It's going to find its way into cracks in the sidewalk, and that they would find somebody and stand them up. And, you know, it's a hard situation because we've spent a lot of time and energy on social equity. But I think, you know, you come up against what you're talking about, which is like a fundamental truth that, you know, it's very hard for the government with their limited resources to police exploitative situations. Or have situations that maybe are fair economically and not exploitative, but at the end of the day are being done to get around this 51% standard. And it's an interesting question, right? What would actually, because the goal is to benefit people in the community. Well, what would benefit them more? Having 51%, but having a situation where they don't really own anything and can't get anything at the end of the day, or a situation where they have a lower percentage, but it really is solidified. And I don't think anybody really knows the answer to that question. What's exciting is that we're seeing states try out all different kinds of models. We talked about the new Oakland one a few months back on the show. We've seen a lot of work in Colorado and Illinois play out. And it's become front and center, obviously, in a lot of other markets that have moved forward. So we're kind of going to see the laboratories of democracy at work on this issue, you know, with a bunch of different options. And we'll see which one works, because at the core, this is the fundamental issue the social equity is in part, not in total, but in part is trying to solve, which is this access to capital issue that I think we spent most of the show kind of laying out all the different barriers to the ways you can get a deal done and get investment. And now we've got to find out from a policy perspective, okay, well, that's clearly a problem. What are potential solutions? And it's kind of cool to see all these different states try different approaches to see if that can actually get us to a place of greater equity in the cannabis industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, it's interesting, like the way I look at things, right, is, you know, we're not, at least the people I work with, the clients I represent, it's sort of like the regulatory environment is sort of what it is for them, right? They're not necessarily thinking about things from a policy perspective. It's more like, okay, this is the environment which we live in. How can I make something happen given these constraints, right? So, you know, I think that even if you don't come from, you know, you just kind of have to roll with whatever the situation is, right? And if you happen to find yourself with a license, but no easy source of capital, I think you just have to be, you know, in the interim, right, you want to be creative about trying to raise capital. Now, it can be a little challenging with securities laws, but you can raise money with the public offering these days. It's called the 506C offering. And you could put an ad out if you wanted to, you know, invest in my cannabis business. You just have to take steps to confirm that everyone who invests is accredited.
Right, which is not something that you can do on the cheap, right? I mean, that sounds like you need a lawyer. And in my experience, anytime you need a lawyer, it sounds like it costs a lot of money, right?
Oh, definitely. Listen, it takes money to make money, baby.
Yeah, I mean, that's the truth, right? And I think that the moral of the story here is that, like, you know, the legal structures, largely due to federal prohibition, you know, it always takes it in this country, the structure is going to favor those with money already. That's how the whole thing has been set up. But federal prohibition actually puts extra pressure on that situation, right? Which I think is really what we're saying this whole time, right?
I guess I would say broader than that. I would say, like, I'm not aware of any human society that doesn't favor those with accumulated capital over those without accumulated capital, right? Whether it be our system or the Soviets, or, you know, people try and perpetuate power. It's just the nature of
it has been. And I think, you know, there's a lot of well-intentioned programs and policy efforts to kind of help folks get a leg up. And I think that, you know, really, I guess the moral of the story, or at least the moral of today's story, is all of that work is extra, extra hard in the cannabis space. And at the same time, obviously extra, extra important, because we know that the consequences of the war on drugs were borne by those without power, those without accumulated wealth, and actually was used to prevent communities from collecting accumulated wealth. And so, you know, you put all of that together and it's like, man, this is triply important for us as we build our industry, but also triply complicated. So I don't know, maybe that's, I don't know what you add all that up to. I'm not a math guy. It sounds like six in total, but it feels like one of those things where there's like one of them factors, and it's actually a lot more than that. You know, it becomes a very challenging needle, you know, to thread.
Yeah, it's not easy, definitely.
So, Charlie, thank you so much. I hope our listeners enjoyed our short diversion away from the normal nerdy policy talk and into corporate law. I kind of learned a little bit more than I knew about corporate cannabis today. And I think it's really important for those of us that work in the policy space to connect as much as possible with people like Charlie, because I can talk all I want about how we should structure economics and investments and policy, but at the end of the day, I don't do that work and I don't know how that stuff works. And I think all of us can learn a lot from those on the corporate side, those on the structuring of transaction side, to ensure that when we are creating these policies that are designed to solve some of the investment issues that we've been talking about, that they can actually do it in a way that's going to work. Because at the end of the day, I can write whatever laws I want, but someone's going to actually have to work with a corporate attorney like Charlie to navigate whatever the heck we lay down. And if we don't understand the intricacies, you know, we can end up with problems that are not as effective as we had once desired. So before we sign off for the day, do you have any other pearls of wisdom, things to share? Reach out to Charlie at Vicente Cederberg.
Yeah, I guess I'll just hawk my, I'll just push my merch one more time. The book is The Cannabis Business, Understanding Law, Finance, and Governance in America's Newest Industry. I'm on Twitter at, I think, Olivacetti at Twitter, or C. Olivacetti. You just Google my name. There's not a ton of Olivacettis in America. Charlie at VicenteCederberg.com if you want to talk law. And I guess we should be based in, I should be back in the office here in Boston in a month or so.
And that's awfully exciting. We're looking forward to being able to see our friends at the office every day. And again, as Charlie mentioned before, all the profits of that book that the authors would receive are being donated to charity. So if you are interested in not only listening to Charlie, you can listen to this show, I guess, a second time, or find him in many different speaking gigs around the country, or you can read Charlie. And now that you've heard him, you can actually put his voice in your ear. And maybe one day there will be even a book on tape. But we're super happy to have you on the show. First time author, Charlie Olivacetti, partner and chair of the corporate department at Vicente Cederberg. Thank you so much for joining us on this Friday afternoon. Appreciate you as always. And stay nerdy, everybody. All right, Shay, make the magic.